Good morning, folks. I hope that you are staying cool. A lot of rain headed this way. Had some bad storms last evening, power outages and the like, and it looks like we're going to have more of that this weekend. So just remember, if you're driving around, I know you're probably tired of me saying this, but that's when you have to be on alert. Take your time. Don't drive fast. It's not worth it. We have a great lineup today. We're going to visit with Rafael Goyeneche. He joins us Thursdays in the 12 o'clock hour every Thursday. And we'll talk about a number of different things. We'll talk about a racketeering case. We'll talk about the criminal district court finding Sheriff Susan Hudson in contempt of court. We'll talk about an internal investigation in the NOPD and other topics as well. Pat Connick, Louisiana State Senator, joins us. He was able to procure a lot of money for the city of Gretna, who actually lost the money as a result of a new councilman being elected representing that area, who the previous councilman that had retired had promised that they would get, and some of those projects had already started, so they were betwixt in between, and we'll talk about that issue with Pat Connick and what he felt compelled to do. Ron Fauché joins us at the top of the hour, 11 o'clock, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics, six-month anniversary of Donald Trump's second presidency. So we'll check in on that, and we'll also talk about the mayor's race. Jay Green, senior research fellow, Center for Education Policy, Heritage Foundation. We will talk with him about education in America, education in Louisiana, education here throughout the metro area. What are the indicators that we should be looking at? Which are the ones that have the most impact? There's a recent Wallet Hub study that they say distinguishes their review from others because they look at 32 defined characteristics in rating where these systems fall out. So look forward to that conversation as well. There was a story posted, it may have been this morning, I think it was. It's first in a series by Jeff Adelson and Jillian Kramer in NOLA.com. And I just finished reading it, and I said, you know what, we're going to talk about this morning because I have to say, and I want to say up front, they did a great job. I don't know what the other, episodes are going to be like in this series and in the writings, but in this one, they were spot on in telling the story about the frustration of murder victims' families and the length of time that it takes in most Louisiana courts, not just New Orleans, albeit New Orleans happens to be the slowest court in the processing of murder cases in the state of Louisiana. But the heartbreak, the cost to the community, and all of these other issues, because some of these cases are taking 9 years to move through the system. The averages in some of the most forward-leaning jurisdictions across the country are way shorter. Some are a third of that. Some are half of that. And it's an issue that we've all seen in most of our careers. If you worked in Louisiana, we had a period of time in Jefferson Parish where we had experienced the same thing. I was in jail over crowded conditions. I was having to make decisions of armed robbers and rapists and stuff like this every day as to who we were going to let out. These are not easy decisions. We used an objective criteria to evaluate these folks. We had the assistance of most of the judges, if not all. And, you know, it was working, but we would hit periods of time where, especially in the female population or in the mental health population, where we were taxed because of the backlog. And again, this is not rocket science. What this requires is an attention to detail on each individual player within the criminal justice system. But just as importantly, it requires collaboration and cooperation. And the mantra should be that we have people's lives who have been permanently altered, and this makes a difference. This is a difference maker to the victims' families. To have them experience and re-energize the PTSD that they've experienced, especially if they were there on the scene, especially if they witnessed it. And how many times do they have to tell their story? That's one of the byproducts of this, but more importantly, it really is a clog in the system that needs to be cleared. And if you look at the makeup of the jail, for example, and we'll talk more about this with Rafael Goyeneche in the noon hour, as to how many people that are there, that are in there for murder, for all of those years, and the financial impact of holding these people for all those years. Sometimes it's a simple tweak. Not always. In my view, for what it's worth, I think we need to have a lot more proactive judges. I think they need to start holding both sides' feet to the fire. I think there needs to be a much more robust pretrial activity that goes on. There has to be definitive dates that we need to hold to, especially if we have out-of-town witnesses coming in. I mean, I've heard stories of witnesses coming in 3, 4, 5, 6 times, flying in. Family members who no longer live here, or who never lived here, who lost a member of their family, who want to be in the court. That's part of how they deal with the grief in their life. And yet they're coming back over and over and over again only to hear that the case has been continued. This is a real issue that needs to be resolved sooner rather than later. It's not a new issue. It's probably been around about 30 years. But it really is going to take kind of a task force approach amongst those in the criminal justice system to try and clear this backlog of cases that we have, to try and move them through the courts as quickly as possible. You know, we have all kinds of evidentiary issues there, access to DNA. Maybe, you know, at some point in time, there should be a meeting, and Governor Jeff Landry's been very amenable to making improvements, and maybe he's willing to do this, is to expand the state police crime lab. A vast majority of law enforcement agencies within the state of Louisiana rely on that crime lab. Others do not. And maybe there can be a priority for murder cases, or maybe there can be two shifts that are worked in the DNA lab to try and clear this backlog of where DNA is actually critical to the case. Now, some people would say, well, no, that's crazy. Well, the reality is that on the investigative side, we have to prioritize how many samples we actually want tested. We have to figure out whether or not the samples that were tested are really meaningful to the case. And it can't be that we're just throwing 30, 40, 50, 60 samples into the lab, because the throughput in a DNA lab is not that great, and it's very costly. But it is a piece of evidence, and it is a process that's incredibly effective. It's great evidence. My sense is that there are a whole lot of people that overutilize it. They're not appropriately trained. They don't understand how the technology truly works or otherwise, and they're not really thinking about the case as to whether or not this has any value add from an evidentiary perspective to the case. Part of the problem is that television has created false expectations of jurors that they feel like if there's no DNA, you know, this thing didn't happen. Well, DNA and fingerprints and other types of evidence like that are really on equal standing. It's not one any more important than the other. There's not one that you're going to likely get a result on more than any other. There are challenges with every type of technology. I get it. But those are excuses that we just have to work through. Now think about the following. In the city of New Orleans, they will not have their DNA lab up if everything goes according to script until 2027. So this problem is going to continue to be exacerbated. We will be building on more and more murder cases. The NOPD has been very successful in their solution of murder cases. They've increased their solution rate by probably 60%, which is huge, something to be celebrated. But the downstream implication of saying is that the system is choked and is choking more today than probably it will ever choke because of the success of the NOPD. I've only said that for 8 years now being on radio. It'll be 8 years in September that I've been on radio. And we've talked about this issue. Be careful what you ask for. We all want a more effective and efficient law enforcement agency. But is the rest of the system prepared? Obviously not. Because we are in jail overcrowded conditions, again and still. The throughput in criminal district court is lacking. That is the one most single important component to you being safe on the streets of your city is throughput in criminal district court. The sooner that you can selectively incapacitate the impact criminal and get them locked up, because the NOPD's arrests are only as good as the DA Jason Williams prosecution, which hopefully leads to a successful outcome, a guilty verdict, that we get to take them off the streets for a period of time and enjoy the fact that they're not out there wreaking havoc on the quality of life and the safety of our communities day in and day out, because impact criminals are in the business of crime. Nothing else. Not a whole lot of anything that they have to offer that's redeeming at all. And the sooner that we come to that realization, the better off we're going to be. There's a direct correlation with how many inmates are in jail right now and the fact that crime is down in Orleans Parish. But the jail is never going to be big enough for us to sit on our laurels in the rest of the system and not move cases, move cases, move cases, move cases. Everyone's taxed for human capital. Maybe it's time that we think about how we might be able to do something differently here. I remember many, many years ago in the city of New York back in the 80s, they had some of the same problems, and they started screening cases in a much more expedited fashion to figure out whether or not they were going to really be able to gather and garner the evidence necessary to charge an individual and hold them, or whether they should be released, continue the investigation of the case, but to really kind of get into the pieces of evidence to make sure that they satisfied probable cause, and things of that nature, and dispense of those issues within 12 to 18 hours of arrest. It was very effective. It slowed that end of the system down a little bit, gave the others an opportunity to catch up. Unfortunately, it put a lot of the criminals back out on the street. But what it compelled was the NOPD to do a much better job in the establishment of probable cause, a documentation of evidence and everything at the scene. and they became a better organization for it. These are the kind of fundamental changes that need to be explored and experimented with sooner rather than later. More of a shock and awe approach to this situation, because time is important and we don't have much. Because meanwhile, as was pointed out very eloquently in this article done by Jeff Adelson and Jillian Kramer, is that we have a lot of other casualties. We have a community that's hurting. We have a victim community that's mystified, confused, frustrated. They feel like no one's listening. They can't get answers. They're scratching their head, wondering, what are the next steps that I have to go through in this system? Is this truly justice? Is this how it works for all cases? A lot of times, we fail to see the obvious. And the obvious simply is, if you lose the public's trust, you have to work three times as hard to get it back. And quite frankly, most organizations don't have the time nor the energy, right, to work that three times as hard to get it back. Because they're busting their backs now. You have to manage it and massage that very carefully. You can't afford to lose it. And maybe the recognition comes about by sitting in the same room together more often. Judges, DAs, enforcement people, looking at the system critically in the mirror every day, making observations as to how they can improve. We've seen a recent happenstance where that's actually worked. Obviously not in the criminal justice system, but it's emblematic of becoming more transparent, level of comfort with everyone. You're not finger-pointing, you're problem-solving. You realize that some of these challenges are not that difficult to overcome. What may at first blush look like a high hurdle may end up being a low hurdle or no hurdle at all. And that was in the preparation for the Super Bowl. Brought a lot of people into a room that have never really sat together. Sat down and listened to what they were doing. Sat there and gained a better understanding of the perspective of the different agencies that are participating in the criminal justice system. We know there's a breakdown in communication. We had a sheriff who was just held in contempt by the chief judge of the Criminal District Court of New Orleans. These are not healthy anecdotes. These are emblematic of a problem or a system that is sick. And when you finish reading the first in this series of reports that'll be done, I think this article is like 26 pages long. It's worth reading. They did a great job, not to beat a dead horse, but they did a great job in encapsulating, capturing the essence of the community's angst and anxiety and pain. We should remind ourselves that that's who we're working on behalf of. Those are our clients. Just a thought. Might be nice to all sit in the same room weekly, develop lists of things that we can do better, develop priorities. There's nothing. You're not violating any ethical rules by doing this. You're working on the system. You're improving the system. Nobody has to divulge what's going on in a case. These are system problems. System issues. point of contact, cooperations, just communicating with people at certain times of the day so that they don't engage in an exercise or a function when the court's not ready for them. You know how much time that saves for the other person? And you can resolve that with a 10-second phone call, a text, or an email? It's amazing. Where you have people that are pushing things along. It's like the folks standing inside of the Walmart. Facilitators, greeters. How can I help you? What are you looking for? Where do you need to go? Why should you look at 20 aisles when I can narrow this thing down to 2? Right? Same thing applies here. As I said before, it's not rocket science. Your takeaway here, after reading this article, is that this needs to be done. Something needs to be done. This is just a suggestion on my part. Today. Not tomorrow. It needs to start happening now. We should take the feelings of the community very seriously. And then and only then will we start reading stories, unlike the one that I read early this morning, about where people are moving to. Right? You know what city was never mentioned? In the article, they talked about state of Texas. Where are those people moving? State of California. Where are they moving? State of Virginia. Where are they moving? State of this. Where are they moving? What city? The city that was never mentioned, not once, New Orleans. Our successes here will create a byproduct that people will put New Orleans on that list. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. There are a lot of different studies about education and, you know, the success rate of some systems and the failures of others. And when you begin to put them all together, everyone's kind of looking at different indicators. Most recently, there was a WalletHub study that looked at 32 key measures of quality and safety as they assessed school systems across the country. Another WalletHub study looked at 15 key indicators of youth risk. So I wanted to talk to someone about what they're thinking and what the contemporary thinking is of what are the really important issues, ingredients for a successful educational system, because a lot of these things seem to conflict with one another. And joining us is Jay Green, Senior Research Fellow, Center for Education Policy, at the Heritage Foundation. Jay, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Jay, what I find about Louisiana is that we definitely rank in the bottom one-third. But what you heard my opening remarks, very confusing about which one of these, you know, so 32 in one and 15 in the other. So, you know, that's 47 different indicators. In your experience, what are the ones that are really stand out and in your mind are really the key ones that you want to look at in an educational system?
Sure. So I'm not sure that I agree that Louisiana is close to the bottom. It depends on what you're ranking and how you're assessing educational systems. According to the Education Freedom Report Card that Heritage puts out each year, Louisiana was actually ranked fourth best in the country among the states. Now, that may be a little surprising to you because you're probably accustomed to people saying that things are bad in Louisiana. And certainly Louisiana has its challenges, and part of that challenge is that it has relatively low income relative to other states. And so it has people who come to schools with problems. And we wouldn't want to judge schools based on the problems that people bring to those schools. We'd want to judge the schools based on how much they help improve those people and help empower the families that send their children there to raise their children in a good way. And in the same way, we wouldn't want to judge a hospital based on how sick their patients are when they arrive. Because then we would think that places like MD Anderson, you know, a cancer research hospital, would be a very bad hospital. But actually, it's widely considered one of the best because it takes on some very challenging patients and does a good job with them. And that's how we really should be thinking about assessing the quality of schools. And I think one of the problems with the WalletHub ranking that just came out that did place Louisiana towards the bottom is that almost entirely the indicators that they're measuring are simply proxies for how wealthy the families are at the beginning, not how much the schools make a difference. And so that's why that's not the most useful way to look at how Louisiana schools are doing.
It's interesting you say that. I never really... I guess I've thought about that at some point in time, but you never really see a study that presents its, you know, its findings that way, right? Be an observation, a nuance. You know, Louisiana is a very poor state, and and then they move on.
Right. Well, we try to, you can make adjustments for this, but you could also, there's a question of priorities too. What do we think schools are there to accomplish? And yes, schools are there to improve skills in reading and math that help young people, enter the workforce, have good jobs and be productive adults. But we also want schools that can help shape good citizens and good character. I think a lot of what parents are looking for when they're looking for schools is a school that can help shape their children's character so that they grow up to be good human beings and behave in virtuous ways as adults. I mean, yes, they want them to make a good living, but they also want them to be decent people. And so one of the important things that the Education Freedom Report Card does that the Heritage Foundation puts out is that it pays a lot of attention to these character formation issues and not simply to skill acquisition, although that's skill acquisition is also important.
Right. And it seems, though, that that's really more of an all-encompassing approach, because what we know now, and I think the numbers are going to be changing even more significantly, I don't think you're going to have as many people going to college. When you look at some of what has been characterized as blue-collar job opportunities out there, we have so many openings in so many of the trades and the skills. It's crazy. And what's also crazy is when you look at the salary surveys of these particular jobs, they far exceed what you would make if you had a four-year college degree.
That's true in many cases. And it's also, you know, pretty obvious when you look at colleges that character formation and the quality of people entering are not good ways of judging educational institutions. I mean, if we simply looked at incoming SAT scores, we'd say that places like Harvard and Columbia were among the best. But when we look at how those institutions shape the character of young people, we see that those are, you know, dangerous institutions to send your kids to, because they might come out as radicals or as believers in things that you find deeply offensive and problematic. And so, you know, if you want to help have schools help you raise your children to be the kinds of adults you want them to be, you know, places like Harvard and Columbia might not be the best. And so looking for K-12 schools and looking for universities that are going to partner with families in raising children to have good skills, good jobs, but also to have good character, that's the whole package that I think people are really looking for.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of emblematic in the most recent news that Columbia University settled its civil rights violations case with the federal government. They just paid them $200 million and an additional $21 million on some other independent investigations relative to federal employment discrimination that was going on at that university. And although did not admit guilt, admitted that the university is in need of reformation.
Look, I think $221 million says we're guilty.
Yeah.
You know, there were really serious problems and still are serious problems at Columbia. It is heartening that they are reaching an agreement with the federal government and pledging to take steps to remediate these problems. And while I don't think we're going to see an overnight transformation of Columbia, I think we're going to see progress. And it's that kind of progress that we should be rewarding in our schools. Progress not just in test scores, but also progress in helping develop people into being good citizens with good character. And Columbia clearly fell short of that. And so, you know, one of the ways that Louisiana schools might be better than you think is that Louisiana first has a lot of school choice. So it has programs, both charter schools and an ESA or educational savings account program that offers private choice. Both of those choice programs empower families to find the right kind of school for their kid and the kind of school that will teach the values that the families hold dear and not be working against the families or undermining the values that families are trying to convey to their children.
Got a text here that says, when you refer to good character, I mean, a lot of folks, you know, they're going to try to jump down to that granular level. But isn't that just, you know, being able to adhere to the traditional norms and customs of your community?
And once upon a time, local public schools were pretty well connected to the values and norms of the communities they served. But schools became increasingly unaccountable and out of touch with the communities that they serve. And so part of the reason why school choice has been so important is that it's helped reconnect schools and communities by making those schools accountable to the families, because the families have to choose them. And look, we're going to have different visions of what good character consists of. Where not all of us will agree, and different communities will have different priorities, and that's all okay. And that's also something that choice can help produce, is that it allows us to find the kinds of schools with the kinds of values that we're trying to teach our children, and they may be different from what other families and other schools will be teaching, and that's okay. But what we don't want is a particular radical vision of character and values imposed on families kind of against their will. That's really problematic. And we have too much of that around the country. And Louisiana is taking important steps to prevent that. And I think that's part of why Louisiana is ranked highly in the Heritage Foundation education report card. It also ranks well on things like transparency, that it has a lot of good information available to families to help them make choices, and to policymakers to help them assess progress. And it also has a good return on investment. We often think that schools that spend a lot are the good schools. But what you really want is a school that gets a lot of achievement for the money it does spend. And while Louisiana doesn't have the highest achieving students in the country, it has remarkably good achievement given the amount that it does spend.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. We truly appreciate your time and your insight. I love the perspective, obviously. Thank you so much, sir.
Sure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's Jay Green, Senior Research Fellow, Center for Education Policy at the Heritage Foundation. We will be right back, folks, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. It's a very interesting conversation, a different way of looking at things. It's kind of why I posed the question the way I did, because I read these surveys all the time, right? And typically, when we're looking at any number of criteria, it causes a little angst and anxiety, especially in the Wallet Hub study. When you think about, and you heard what Jay talked about, as they come in, you don't want to hold that against the system because they're not responsible for that. But we have the second highest poverty rate in of our children that are entering school in the country. We have the highest percentage of disconnected youth. And, you know, so we also have the seventh highest percentage of overweight and obese youth here. So, you know, it's hard to hold the school accountable for these certain criteria. And it's not to say that this Wallet Hub study and other studies are not important. They are. But, you know, the gains that are made while there, and the opportunities provided while there, and the percentage of students that take advantage of the opportunities while there, is certainly something to be considered. There's no doubt that when you have the vast majority of families that are being raised by single-parent households, that it's just not as good as if you had two-parent households. I mean, there's so much data about that. And that's not to mean if you have a single-parent household you can't succeed, because you can. I mean, it's just harder, right? You got to work harder at it. There's no doubt about it. So it's a very interesting perspective as to how we judge our schools. One thing for sure, no matter what survey you look at, Louisiana is and has been experiencing improvements. Used to be 49th or 50th in just about every category. That's not the case any longer. In fact, in reading test scores, the most recent study had us at 24th in the nation, which was good, 38th on math. And so we moved up, because not too many years ago we were in the high 40s. So that, again, when you're looking at that positive movement there and improvement in the schools, is something important to judge them by. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Folks, when we return after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Ron Fauché, political analyst and publisher of Lunchtime Politics. Donald Trump is celebrating his six-month anniversary of being the 47th president. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the big, beautiful bill, tariff accomplishments, immigration, national security, foreign policy. We'll also touch on the mayor's race. At 11:30, Pat Connick joins us, Louisiana State Senator, about funding of projects for the city of Gretna.